Mind Crime Liberty Show with me, Swithin Dobson, and him, Tim Patton. Today we discuss, is libertarianism reactionary or libertine? Tim.
You get two groups of people accuse libertarianism. Now, I don't think this is entirely a dispute over the definition of words of what exactly is libertarianism. Because on the one hand, people like Noam Chomsky would like to think that libertarianism equals private tyranny. Even Kevin Carson would agree that, you know, in some ways that libertarianism is just private tyranny. It would just be exploitation done by fathers. It would just be a form of patriarchy and so forth. Because people would just be subject to their husbands, or they'd be subject to private corporations, or subject to private charities. And of course, all these would be all reactionary. But on the other hand, you get religious conservatives, such as Albert Mohler, and there's some others, that think libertarianism primarily means free love, abortion, pornography, the abolition of family, and pot smoking. So you get libertarians and gets accused of two simultaneous things. And now someone like David Friedman said he's so far right that he thinks that gun control should be allowed, but so far left that you think that abortion and as well as gay marriage should be allowed. Now, there are ways you can square this circle. There are plenty of ways you might be able to square this circle. And one of the simplest ways is to say that libertarianism is both. Libertarianism is liberty, which is sort of the Walter Blockian position. The trouble with that position to me remains is that, you know, what exactly would be the general case of what a hypothetical or historical, what we think of as historical and analog to a libertarian society would be? You know, would it be broadly reactionary or conservative even, or mildly traditional, depending on one's parlance? Or would it, on the other hand, be progressive or liberal, depending on one's parlance? As you can see, both, and this, in some ways, this conversation mirrors the thick versus thin debate recently, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. I think this video has like 20,000 views. It's like, it's Hans Hoppe on the PFS Society on realistic libertarianism. In there, he sort of roasts Jeffrey Tucker. And Jeffrey Tucker, in a way, currently represents, you know, at least in the Mises type, ex-Mises type crowd, a more, you know, libertine version of it, that libertarianism is primarily about women's rights and gay rights and all these things. And on the other hand, Hans Hoppe and like people like Stefan Molyneux are almost, depending on who you talk to, they're almost quasi-reactionary, even possibly more than that. So Rick Story, broadly, from my overview of what I just suggested and described, you think my characterizations are in general fair? Because, you know, libertarians do get criticized at everything. And again, I don't think this is just merely a dispute over the definition of word libertarian, but in general, what would a broadly libertarian framework lead to, a libertine or reactionary outcome?
I do actually agree with you that libertarians can be mischaracterized, I think, rather unfairly. It's very common, isn't it? You know, folks on the left will say that libertarians are sort of crypto fascists, perceiving fascism as reactions to inevitable declines as a result of capitalism, and of course on the right they'll see, you know, probably some socially liberal attitudes in most libertarians, especially in America, of course, and they will say, oh well, this is liberalism, and in the sense that they mean it to be left-wing, you know, sort of degenerate behaviors amongst the youth and that kind of thing. So yeah, I entirely agree with you that libertarianism can be mischaracterized. For me, and this is the definition of libertarianism that I defend in my book, The Uniqueness of Western Law. Libertarianism is simply a theory of law. It's simply jurisprudence. It's the sort of jurisprudence that uniquely emerged from Western civilization, in which we, you know, since the time of the ancient Greeks, of course, and elsewhere in Europe, let's not forget forget, Europeans were, you know, markedly different to the situation across the Orient, whereby or in which you had a what we used to call the Oriental despot, you know, where law was effectively something just commanded by fiat of the king. In Europe, law was something that was rationally discovered, and so law was always something that was ruling over the kings. It was, you know, it was truly the rule of law. It was something objective, and it was something, in that sense, you know, sort of qualitatively real. It was ideal, and it was something that kings had to obey just as other people. And now this definition of libertarianism as being, you know, kind of rationalistic jurisprudence, that's not something that I just plucked out of thin air. And actually, a lot of libertarian scholars, like, for instance, Walter Block or Lou Rockwell or even Hans-Hermann Hoppe or even Frank Van Dunn, you know, they agree with me explicitly in the advanced praise for my book that, you know, that really is the kernel, the crux of libertarianism. It's important to distinguish libertarianism from liberalism, because where you have liberalism, you have more of a tolerance for a plurality of different cultures and views and definitions of things, you know, even like justice, even the definition of justice. And so in a situation like that, I think you could see a trend towards more libertine behaviors under liberalism. You know, what is liberalism? We've got to define that as well. It's the lack of there being a public belief. There's a lack of a public creed, in the sense that all beliefs are considered private. They're a private matter, and so this can allow for, of course, you know, plurality of religions, for instance, to exist within a territory. Within a united territory, within one nation state, for example. And it's not so much that there isn't a public creed, it's just that the only public creed that there is that all beliefs are private. You know, that is the only public creed. And so, you know, the state is pretty much there to defend that. And depending on how liberal the state is, and of course in the West, because of our history, you know, principally, we do tend to be more liberal. And so in our societies, you know, we will allow for all sorts of different groups to form. And, you know, especially as Christianity wanes in its political influence, we see a rise in all sorts of behaviors that are almost, you know, reactionary to Christianity, and they are, you know, there are behaviors and things that are legalized, which, you know, before, under perhaps more Christian times, would have been completely unthinkable. And so I think when it comes to saying, you know, does libertarianism lead to more reactionary behaviors in people or more liberal behaviors in people, you know, we've really got to define what libertarianism is. I mean, especially as, I mean, there is the argument that where you have libertarianism and where people have to take more individual responsibility, they will start to behave in more conservative, let's just say, for the sake of argument, ways. So I'll leave it at that. I hope I've answered the question well enough.
Yes, thank you, Rick. I would say, just taking like the sort of libertarian legal order as you've described, that libertarianism is a form of sort of jurisprudence, what kind of outcomes would that lead to? I mean, certainly on the sort of fiscal side, it's likely to lead to more longer term behavior, a lower time preference, and generally more personal financial responsibility, in that you have no welfare state, at least no sort of state enforced one. There may well be sort of welfare provided voluntarily by charities or churches or other voluntary organizations. But I would suspect that they would be less likely to be abused and relied upon, just because, well, you know, you're taking the church's money, you're taking this local charity's money. It's not seen as a right in the way it is today. So I think there'd be proportionally kind of less take up, or some more sort of social stigma is probably the wrong term, but you get the idea. I mean, you don't really want to be taking unless you really need to, type thing. So I think certainly on the financial front, you're likely to see different forms of behavior than you do at present. The question then arises, well, what about sort of Chomsky's complaint of sort of private tyranny, or Carson's as well? Well, I suppose, at least in Carson's view, that depends on what the libertarian view is on land ownership, because he would take the occupancy and use position, as opposed to the sort of Lockean one, and that would lead to different outcomes. And I think Carson would put that as like a defining feature of his sort of mutualism relative to, say, Rothbardianism, and that would make a difference with respect to wealth imbalances and income imbalances. But as we discussed in another episode on whether megacorps had take over, I'm of the view that you would have wealth disparity, but it would not be on the same level as it is today. So whilst of private tyranny, if you want to call it that, of unequal bargaining power could result from a libertarian order, I don't think it's going to be nearly as great as it is today with the state and privileges for corporations, etc. Then you get to the criticism of Al Mohler, etc. Would libertarianism lead to abortion, drugs, and getting high, etc.? Well, there I suppose you could make a claim that that might be more likely. Let's circumscribe here as to whether or not libertarianism say abortion is should be legal or not. Are you going to get polyamory, etc., etc.? Well, I suppose yes, you could. To some extent. The question, I think, would be, in a sense, really with this is, you know, what's the libertarian legal order's approach to children, which is actually probably largely undefined. I mean, Walter Block says that, you know, children are the biggest problem to sort of political philosophy, although I suppose that's true if you take the individual as your starting point rather than the family or any other structure. But I think on the libertarian order, I think it would depend upon, in this very sort of narrow way I'm looking at it at the present, what the approach would be to children. If it was the case that, well, you know, you're the biological father, you need to pay up, then you might expect more judicious approaches from men with women. Now, that said, if contraception works fine, then I suppose then you could say all bets are off. Well, not entirely, but more so than it would be if, you know, contraception either didn't work as well or wasn't around. So the social one, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, it's certainly possible that it could go that way. But those would be my sort of initial thoughts as to what we would expect a result of a libertarian. Leaving aside, you know, whether or not you need certain underpinnings to make it work. I'm just saying, let's just assume that away for the sake of argument here. Let's just look at the legal order. What would it lead to? Economically more responsible, socially and stuff, unclear, I would say. Tim?
The unclearness on the social issue, to me, depends to a large extent on what the historical state is. And this is where I think the religious conservatives are somewhat confused about how we got here to this point. The state in general, to me, has been largely a progressive, progressive outcome. Whether or not a state itself is progressive, I don't think the state itself is a very progressive institution. That's one of the reasons why I like left libertarians. They at least own up to the fact that the state itself is a sort of is a reactionary, in some sense reactionary, in some sense a very illiberal institution. I mean, it's a gang or it's a sort of recognized legitimate gang. But I think this is where a lot of the religious conservatives are sort of confused. Because let's say we just legalize abortion. If you took away the NHS or certain mandatory health care insurance backed by the state away, would that lead to more or less abortions? There is a scenario in maybe some hypothetical where we have abortion charities. There is the scenario that is a possibility. But if you have any sort of healthcare system, private healthcare, you'd have the freedom of the conscience in theory to not go ahead with it. And if you don't have any transfers of wealth, you would almost predict that there'd be less of it. You can make a clear argument that there'd be less of it if you got rid of some kind of socialized medicine. Of course, if you just ran it on private charities and you just had almost anything goes, it could of course have the opposite as well. You could have some sort of Margaret Mead Inc. charity that just pays women to abort their children. That's possible. But I think this is where Albert Mueller is generally confused. And also, I think this is where I think the far left tends to make a point regarding, social relations. But this is again that gets tricky about what exactly the state is. Again, I would say the state is in some ways a homebreaker. I mean, you get this from Peter Hitchens. You get this. The state does have an incentive to break up the marriages and families so they can send them to public schools, send them to the militaries, and make them all atomized just so the state can deal with them. There is an incentive to that. And I think that remains a problem with Kevin Carson, Chomsky, those types of mutualist sort of left libertarians. What comparable institution for the state? The right is easy. It's just say, well, put the families back in charge. But this is where I think this is where Rick's point, in some ways Christianity is somewhat progressive in its progressive compared to the Romans. So, a lot of things people complain about, especially the left complains about the Christianity took away from the Greeks, were actually quite good. And they improved marriage and family life and made it much more. So I do think broadly the underpinning of Western libertarianism would be Christianity or some framework like that. I mean, maybe some sort of Greek system, it might work, but in general, the likely candidate is Christianity, which is the underpinning. But that's tricky because then people like Albert Mueller and even Gary North will say, well, we need to add things to that, and it quickly becomes a thicker and a thicker doctrine. So, with the two of you, and we'll start with Rick, would you agree that one of the broad underpinnings of Western liberty is Christianity? Could it be something else? I mean, even societies people might put as sort of Western, take a South Korea or take a Taiwan or take even a Japan, there's a huge amount of a significant Nassim Taleb minority of, he has a rule of a minority, there's a significantly voiceful minority of all those countries of Christians, it's worth pointing out, as Japan probably the least way, but definitely with South Korea and Taiwan. Do you think liberty in the West, libertarianism in the Western context, can only exist in like historical Christian. I'm using all umbrellas of Christianity. So Rick or Swithin, I'll start with Rick.
Well, yes, I do actually. Quite strongly, I do strongly think that Christianity is a very, very important, essential, I would say, underpinning of any what we would call libertarian legal order. Now, the reason I think that is because, let's look at Swithin's example from a moment where he was talking about children just now. What would the situation be with children if all of a sudden there was no state in place and, potentially very large companies like Amazon and Google were creating some sort of neo-feudalism where they They even owned their own cities, and people were becoming serfs, you know, serving their entire life, not owning any property, but just renting themselves out for life in order to have accommodation and maybe other pleasures. You know, imagine some sort of maybe dystopian, maybe you think it's utopian future like that. Well, what would the attitudes towards children be? Immediately, we have to recognize what Rothbard said, certainly in his later work, which is that libertarians tend to completely forget about the importance of culture. It's something that you know, Jeff Deist, the president of the Mises Institute, and various others continually tried to point out. We need to understand that our moral norms, all of these things, that even the language that we are using to speak right now, all these ideas, all of these frames and metaphors and things in our mind, we have got this not from simply being individuals. We have necessarily taken all of this in, imbibed all of this from a culture, from our culture, as have our families. And so I think it's very important to consider, you know, the cultural reasons we do things. Now, libertarianism, as we know it, as a legal order, this emerged out of the Christian West, out of Christian Europe, Christendom, Latin Christendom, whatever you want to say. And it's for this reason that, you know, even someone like Hans Hermann Hoppe, who is not himself a Christian, certainly not to my knowledge, I think he's expressed that he isn't, has said that, you know, the most important time in history, really, for Christians to look at and to say, okay, you know, this is really what a libertarian order would realistically look like, is the era of Latin Christendom, you know, Europe, you know, before the fall of Christendom in the 1500s. And you know, the reason for that is that you had obviously European people, and you know, demographics is extremely important when it comes to culture. Very individualistic people, you know, as I said before, it was in Europe that very rationalistic, competitive schools of thought, particularly in legal philosophy, were developed and allowed to develop and welcomed even. This was not the case elsewhere. And when Christianity came along, what you saw was the strongest form of corporatism in the concept of the Eucharist, or the communion that we have, and we consider ourselves to be, you know, really one body in Christ. You know, we become one in a mysterious, but in some sense more real than real way. And also you had the very individualistic culture of Europe. And it was out of this that, for instance, families in previous European orders, like, for instance, Rome, pagan Rome, you know, a father who was the paterfamilias could brutalize his children, brutalize his wife. And so with Christianity then came this understanding that, no, we're individuals. We have individual responsibilities before God. We will have to explain ourselves before God. We're each individually made in the image of God. And therefore, in this system, through canon law, through church law, women and children suddenly had a recourse to law in order to stop brutal husbands and fathers. Women and children were no longer considered like the chattels of a father, you know, the leader of a household anymore. I think it's very important to understand. It's very important to understand the Christian foundations of really of law, because when you consider the law around the world, we have to consider the huge impact that Western law has had around the world. I mean, there are plenty of scholars who would even say that what we know as law is something uniquely Western. It sounds terribly arrogant, but I can assure you it's not just Western Eurocentric scholars that would say such things. Certainly, at the very least, they would say that law is uniquely central to European civilizations in a way that it hasn't been elsewhere. And so when we consider, you know, that was fundamentally Christian, our developments of everything from, you know, international law, merchant law, company law, all different forms of law that you would care to think of. And I'm talking internationally still. They have their foundations, they have their roots, they have their definitions in a Christian cultural framework. And I mean, obviously, okay, as a Christian, I do think Christianity is the best cultural technology that humans can possibly have. I don't think it can be beat. In terms of, does libertarianism depend on it, though? Certainly, the Christian concepts, you know, we are all under God. We are all have a responsibility. Kings have a responsibility towards their subjects before God, and they must obey the law of God. Absolutely. This is automatically libertarian, and it's something that you don't see in quite the same way. It's not as well developed in pre-Christian Europe, something approximating it just never arose anywhere else in the world. So I mean, in a sense, this is a miracle. This is a miracle that Christianity, as Christ said in the Gospel of Matthew, passed the kingdom of God passed from the Jews, and it was given to another nation. It was given to the Romans, the baddies, and it totally changed Rome, and it's totally changed the world. Christ has permanently changed the definition of love for the whole world. Irrevocably, and that permanently changed the way law works internationally. You wouldn't have the various concepts of human rights, etc., things like that, and of course the various libertarian legal principles that we know and love, without the changes wrought by Christ.
I would broadly agree with Rick's assessment. The emphasis on sort of the individual as being a valuable sort of component of society in and of himself or herself, as Rick has pointed out, does seem to be a Christian development. You do have sort of broadly individualist societies in pagan Europe. But it isn't to, at least to my knowledge, is not nearly to the same extent as it is sort of developed later. And Christianity does seem to be have a big impact on that with respect to the individual's relation to God and his responsibility to the rest of society, etc. Whereas if you look, say, more at, I mean, take Plato and Aristotle, for example, they don't have a particular emphasis on the individual at all. It's about the city. You know, where do you sit in the city and the just ordering within that? Now, of course, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that per se, but there isn't really a huge emphasis on the individual and their role that you would get, say, later. And especially with things like human rights, etc. I mean, I think human rights and rights language is, originally it's not post-Christian, but it certainly is kind of in the way that it is created today. Now, is it the case that you would need Christianity per se to have a libertarian order? Historically, I think that's been true. Theoretically, I suppose some form, well, probably a philosophical theism in which there is sort of an objective sort of legal framework which is incumbent upon everybody to adhere to. I think that's probably going to be required. Otherwise, those in power can just, who are the judges or whatever, can become their own, they can make their own law and become legal positivists. So I don't think it's in principle require Christianity, but certainly historically that seems to have it's developed. Now, on a more specific cultural matter, I think an interesting lecture was by Ed Faeser. I think it was the Heritage Foundation, if I remember correctly, on basically why socialism is bad. But he made an interesting point that effectively society will always, well, it's interesting. He would say it would always be concerned about the innocent, in a sense. So if you had lots of children out on the streets who weren't being cared for by their parents, etc., etc., they would tend to end up being a groundswell support that we must do something about this. And if the parents and the families can't be or cannot be trusted to do this, then we must need an outside agency to provide for them. And so his argument was essentially that you need sort of like a strong family structure where care is given to the people who need care, to need to be cared for, basically children or sort of aged relatives, I imagine, or the retarded or something along those lines. And then sort of everybody else can kind of deal with each other as sort of relatively legal equals. This would then allow the framework for sort of like he's not a libertarian, but he used to be. You would allow sort of my interpretation of his framework, this would sort of have the conditions to allow like a broad libertarian legal order to work. Because if there were people, everyone was thinking, hang on, no, they need to be dealt with on such a large scale, such that you might think that a voluntary way of sorting that couldn't take place. Now, obviously, if there were also deontological libertarians, might go, no, we can't do it. We'll have to just, get voluntary donations on Indiegogo. But if you don't make it, well, the kid dies. That's possible, but that doesn't seem to be the way societies tend to work. I would say one of the cultural requirements would be that you need intact families where the dependents are, in the main taken care of by their relatives or other, well, typically them, because it's not unlikely to be other organizations have the same interest. And then this would provide sort of a stability for society as a whole because of all the other accompanying benefits that has. But there wouldn't be the case of, oh, no, what about, the poor children being thrown in the streets? I mean, for example, I mean, this is where all the welfare spending, well, not all of it, but if you look at the welfare spending, it's pretty much all revolves around children. I mean, if you're especially a single mother with kids, I mean, you get showered with money from the state, because the way it's gone is everyone thinks, well, it's not really the kid's fault. We need to help him out. And I think that kind of generates kind of the welfare state in that way. That said, now, historical questions of why the welfare state arose is another question, because it probably isn't that reason. So maybe that's not a sufficient requirement, but I think it's at least necessary. Or if it's not necessary, it's very close to being necessary. Tim, any comments on things going for so far?
The historical development of the welfare state, at least here in the United States, in particular regards to the whatever you call them, the black population, is quite interesting in the sense that in some ways it was literally just money that was thrown at it. And if you read someone like Thomas Sowell, it's worth pointing out that they probably had more intact family structures circa 1950 or so than whites than they do today. So now they actually have significantly worse than whites, and a corresponding growth in income inequality. Although that depends on how you calculate various numbers like prices and inflation. So that's a bit of a rabbit hole to go into. But nonetheless, the fact that you can get that result leads one to the conclusion that it's pretty probable that it is welfare is in some ways a solution in search of a problem. It's a solution in search of a problem. It might even create more problems. It creates sort of a moral hazard problem that cuts it away. So and we sort of discussed that a little bit, not in depth, with Keith Preston on maybe not two episodes ago as well. A lot of times I think what basically encounters in the left generally, people like Chomsky, people like Kevin Carson, basically give a lot of libertarian lifeboat scenarios. Like, what do you do about the child in the street? I think this is what certain conservatives do to libertarians too. What do you do with the child that gets thrown out in the street? Well, is this a general occurrence or is this a one-time thing? You know, let's say the child is just left home and everyone they know dies in a car accident. Well, that's not going to happen that often. That's an obscure example. If that's an obscure example, you shouldn't try to construct a legal theory to some very obscure exception. But if in general, if kids are just getting thrown out on the streets, this society is just going to be a hellhole anyway. I don't think libertarianism is the problem. And Tyler Cowen points this out within his interview with Russ Roberts. Tyler Cowen wrote a great book called The Great Stagnation. And Russ Roberts was in this. Now he's a sort of Beltway Reason magazine type libertarian. I say that in somewhat positive ways, somewhat negative ways. There's a lot to like about Russ Roberts. But one of the points that Cowen made is that, like, has the last 70 or so years in the United States and British history been libertarian? No way. I mean, we've seen the growth of the state. We've seen the decline of Christianity, growth of the welfare state, growth of health care, growth of state education. This is what sort of bugs me about the people like Albert Mohler and other social conservatives is we haven't had anything close to a libertarian order since the 1940s. It's been the total opposite direction. Now, I do agree in the United States, just to sort of satisfy certain anarcho-syndicalists as well as some people like Keith Preston, is that it's not been communists with a capital C. I do agree that we haven't had full-scale communism. Ironically, the places that went full-scale communism are now swayed over as actionary societies in some ways. There's a great lecture by Peter Hitchens on why he likes Russia, and so forth. So in some ways, you get the whole disease. You come out in that way. So I do agree the origins of the problem is what the trouble with the conservatives, and I think the trouble with the far left libertarians. I broadly like the left libertarians like Chomsky or Carson, but my retort to them is, what exactly do you do with the state if you're an actual anarchist, if you're an actual critic of the state? And there is problems that you could identify with, but they identify problems like defense are in some ways everyone's problems. They're just as much as, you know, the Orwellites and the Chomskyites and the Carsonites problems, as well as not just the right libertarian problems. If you subject people to self-defense problems, how does a mutualist commune defend itself? Who knows? I mean, maybe you need a conscript military. So those problems, I think, you can just sort of set aside. But in general, I think libertarians of any stripes are coherent enough that you can argue with them. You can put their points. Because a lot of political commentators in general, I think, are in some ways hacks or incoherent or just mainstream commenters in general. Most Marxists today, even Marx himself is actually quite interesting, as Hans Hoppe points out. His theory is much more the actual Marx, and Marx later in life said, whatever I am, I'm not a Marxist. So the historical Marx might actually be in some technical ways in agreement with certain aspects of libertarian, but it again depends on the state. So I'm going to pass it to Rick. Anything you disagree or agree with me? And then getting into the and later questions here we have. So, Rick?
Well, I'd agree with you that Noam Chomsky is very interesting. I definitely agree with that. It's a shame. I mean, being a linguist, I mean, that is his academic background. It's a shame that his big idea of universal grammar, you know, that all the peoples in all the world, they've got to have some basic like grammar, and so there must be something neurologically that's causing us to identify and create grammar. I mean, sadly, that's all been completely disproven. Nevertheless, I mean, you know, he does make some good political commentary, and I think that the left do have some valuable criticisms of capitalism that libertarians just seem to ignore, and you know, we do need to take that up. However, I don't think they're much better, you know, especially folks like Noam Chomsky, because they, like libertarians, can tend to ignore the importance of certain aspects of culture, and for the left in particular, it's religion. Now, I mean, you know, for all of Noam Chomsky's wanting to universalize, you know, how we use grammar or how we need to identify grammar or something like that, he's failed to identify, or sorry, he's failed to recognize something which you really can identify as a human universal, which is the need for self-transcendence and to know that there are, in society, I mean, manifest in society, there is a cultural framework which is identifying virtuous behaviors, and, you know, the way you should really be. And, you know, this is a human need, even if the person only vaguely assents to these things and doesn't necessarily believe in God or whatever it is. And they might not actually, you know, behave in the right way themselves a lot of the time. Nevertheless, they have this need to know that that is there in society, and that is a strong source of security when it is there. But it's also it provides a lot of identitarian pathologies when it isn't there, and it causes people to seek it in the most bizarre of places and even to invent their own ideologies just for themselves, you know, and they invent all sorts of bizarre personalities for themselves, and just to have a sense of identity, just to have a sense that there is something transcendent to them that they are reaching out towards, some kind of ideal self that they're reaching out towards. And yes, I think the left tend to ignore that. I think libertarians can also tend to ignore the importance of that. So the example that Swithin had raised before, talking about an essay by Edward Faeser, was quite important, because Edward Faeser is, in a sense, you know, over-universalizing certain things. He had said, I think you said, Swithin, that people would naturally see, if there were children just left to themselves, and there might be a sort of groundswell saying, well, we need to do something about this. Well, okay, well, look at the Spartans, for instance. I mean, did they have that attitude about, you know, children, you know, left to fend themselves? No, I mean, they made a rite of passage out of it. And also, I mean, you can see, you know, in some parts of Africa and Asia, and, you know, this is not to make fun of them or anything like that, but, you know, there are some places where familial abandonment for one reason or another is quite common. And so you will have children who are left to fend for themselves, and, you know, others are considered to be in such harsh conditions that they can't really assist, let alone start some sort of political movement to try and assist with these children who've been abandoned and they're having to look after themselves. So what's the point here? What's the point I'm trying to make? Well, the point I'm trying to make is that we have to be careful about what we're universalizing, that, you know, everyone would do in certain circumstances, this sort of thing. As I say, culture, demographics, things like this, they might be taboo, but nevertheless, you know, the data show these things are extremely important in understanding how people would behave, what sort of laws they want, what sort of, you know, definitions of justice they'll come up with, what kind of markets for injustice will emerge from their communities, their groupings together. These are extremely important considerations. And, you know, what can I say? I would just inevitably come back to my point that I don't think we can really underestimate. I don't think you can really overestimate the importance that Christianity has had in producing the uniquely libertarian orders that we have in Europe.
I would agree with you with the point on Faeser. I try to clarify it, but yeah, I think his position is primarily a uniquely Christian sort of Christian or post-Christian attitude to sort of abandon children and such. Although, whilst it's obviously infanticide is quite common, they had the Spartans, etc. If you had something comparable sort of today, maybe you get, did you have it to the same extent? I'd have to do some empirical investigation, but yeah, I do think Fraser's point is somewhat true in a Christian or post-Christian society rather than the pre-Christian one. With your point with respect to self-transcendence, I think that's true to some extent, that people think there needs to be something beyond themselves to sort of give themselves some sort of solid meaning of certain descriptions. And in the absence of that, you can try and sort of deify things on earth. And so, you know, you mentioned sort of identitarian positions and to some extent there. And I think that that's broadly true. And that's something you wouldn't want in a broadly libertarian legal order if you didn't have like a solid sense of God or some sort of rational thing beyond yourself, because otherwise, you know, these sort of views will arise, and which have then caused, of course, damage to the libertarian legal order. With respect to Tim's point about have we had libertarianism in the last 50 years? Well, the answer is obviously no. Well, I think that's true. I mean, that's certainly true. However, the social conservative like Al Mohler could say, ah, yes, but the libertarians, well, you supported abortion. Oh, we had abortion, we got loads of it. And you supported the liberalization of the divorce laws, and look, we got loads of divorces. And your protestation, we didn't have real libertarianism, is the same as the communists saying, well, you know, Stalinism wasn't real communism. Now, I think there's a continuum here. I do think that sort of Stalinism is kind of significantly closer to utopian communism than the latter half of the 20th century is to sort of argumentational ethics-based society. But that's certainly something you could make the case for. So, for example, I mean, Rothbard would have supported the abortion change and would have supported the divorce changes as well, because Rothbard thought effectively that, you know, in a sense, even like employment contracts are illegitimate because it binded the will of the individual in the future. And so, you know, would certainly be in favor of being able to devolve marriages at will. Now, they may have been a performance bond, his favorite performance bond, that, you know, you agree prior to the marriage, you know, if you happen to leave, that you will pay the spouse a certain amount of money. So you might only have to buy yourself out and you might not be able to afford to do so, possibly. But certainly, certain conceptions of libertarianism, I think that you could argue is libertarian change, and then Al Mohler goes, oh, this is bad. And then you get the question of, well, you need to argue for more things changing at once. But then the question is, well, can we ever see what the results of it are unless we get sort of quote unquote utopian libertarianism, which should say the similar response of the socialist, the communist. But as I say, I do think there's a continuum there, and I wouldn't think that was a necessarily fair characterization. But it is certainly true that certain libertarians have supported those positions. And so as such, it's not entirely unreasonable that some parties would point that out. On to what a libertarian legal order would look like. I think really what libertarians think a libertarian order will look like largely depends on why they're a libertarian as such. So I had a bit of a think about this before, and I came up with what I thought were broadly five types of libertarian. So the first was sort of the Ortiz plumb line type, like Bloch, Rothbard and Kinsella, who just think, well, it's what's justifiable, and, you know, everything else, this is just true. And, you know, well, whatever results in it, that's what it results in. And now, interestingly, though, Bloch, Rothbard, possibly to some extent Kinsella, are both reasonably socially conservative. I mean, certainly Bloch is on sort of a personal level, which I do think is interesting with these sort of plumb line types, because none of them really in their sort of, they would say it was a good idea, is kind of like crazy. So So libertinism would be a good idea. They wouldn't advocate that. So those guys are kind of agnostic and don't really talk about it. So Roth, I imagine Block will just talk about, oh, well, everyone's just enforcing property rights and homesteading. So those are the first type who don't really talk about culture particularly. Then you've got the thick left libs. And by thick, I don't mean stupid. I mean, there's people like, as Tim's pointed out, Carson, other like Gary Chartier or Roderick Long, who, and also you could argue Jeff Tucker now to some extent, although I'm not entirely sure how it justifies his own position, who would see libertarianism not just as a theory of law, but it's sort of as an outgrowth of various moral considerations of not imposing your will on other people, being egalitarian, etc., etc. And consequently, because of that's their foundation of their view of libertarianism, they of course think, you know, we're going to get a nice egalitarian sort of broadly libertine society as a result of it. Another type of libertarian would be the pure individualist, sort of like the Stirnerite or Nietzschean. Again, they wouldn't really point to culture that much, apart from possibly the Nietzschean types, who would say, well, you know, you've got these great men who just sort of dominate society, I suppose. And I suppose to some extent that's sort of Ayn Rand's position, with the big businessman being the most oppressed minority in society. You know, he's been held back to impose his will on society. You then get to the fourth type, is kind of the Hoppean type, who I've called like the autiste libertarian, but we'll go further than, it's obviously autiste because of his argumentational ethics, but goes further than Block and saying, you know, well, social conservatism is kind of good, but it's not related. You know, Hopper says, well, if you want to maintain sort of like pure justifiable legal order, then we must have social conservatism to withhold it, to uphold it. So he's sort of like a fusion of sort of broadly sort of radical positions. And then sort of the fifth type is sort of the right libertarian, who would see libertarianism as like the best ordering of to produce a socially and economic, a just social and economic order. They wouldn't necessarily base it in sort of abstract rights theory, etc., in the way that say Rothbard does or Hopper or Block. But you know, they might take more broader sort of moral considerations into account and different things like that. But then go, well, yeah, broadly, libertarian order is a way to achieve that. And so obviously those types would go, yeah, well, we need a socially conservative order for it because, well, we kind of like that, and that's one of the reasons we like libertarianism. So I think what a lot of libertarians think libertarianism will lead to largely depends on their view as to why they're a libertarian, which I think is broadly true, because if it was the case everyone thought like they did on certain issues, then you might tend towards that type of society. So if everyone thought like Roderick Long or Kevin Carson, it could well end up being a libertine society. Just the question of whether or not that's stable or not, and that's sort of a separate question. So that's where I would go with, you know, what libertarianism would look like, and it depends really what's motivating the support for libertarianism. Tim?
As far as the five types, my own personal view is somewhere between the first type, the autiste plumb line, or the maybe the Hoppean right libertarian version, or maybe even the Nietzschean position. I'm definitely not a thick left lib in any regard. In some metaphysical sense, I think as far as Christianity is concerned, to tie some of the earlier points made together, I ultimately think that the only thing, all secular moral theories are false in the sense that they don't have any final justification because they don't have any final end teleology or any appeal can be made to natural law. So in some sense, all secular theories, moral philosophy in general, false. I mean, I'm not saying that secular people can't concoct, you know, categorical imperatives or concoct some sort of utilitarianism. But you get all sorts of problems, like, you know, why can't I just kill a million people to save 10 million? You get all sorts of problems. And they'll say, well, that's just that you're just parodying, you're not being charitable. But even being charitable in argumentation is a sort of a value in itself. And as Rick said, the only value in our society is the value that we don't have values or something like that. I think that's roughly true. It's roughly true here in the West, in the sense that in some ways Christianity has been vacant. The Christianity has been, you know, vacated. You know, people don't believe in anything. And the trouble is, as G.K. Chesterton pointed out, people believe in anything. And all those secular theories are largely false or problematic and prone to all sorts of problems. So, on the highest level, you know, it comes down to whether or not Christianity is true or false. If Christianity is true, you can justify Christianity on Nietzschean grounds too. You could just say Christ is the most aristocratic person, most powerful person. You can just say he's the ultimate Übermensch. There's a sort of way to do that. If anyone should read work of Dallas Willard, it's very excellent justification. But my own, as far as in secular sense, I am an autiste plumb line. I'm, you know, in the sense that I just sort of look at things, try to figure out what would be the ideal society based on some sort of norms. And I think Hoppe's justification, or Habermas's justification of argument, taste, and excess, is quite a solid foundation. The left, all, you know, any Habermas himself assumes, this comes from Habermas, you know, the left in general assumes all sorts of things. You could just as easily argue that only socialism or only socialism in broadly extent can work in a Christian society. And actually some of the better better varieties probably have occurred in the, you know, historical Christian area dominated them. So in the same way, as far as Al Mohler's and Swithin's point to contradict that, that is in a way true. I just think libertarianism is in some ways a superior intellectual thing in itself compared to communism broadly due to technical things. And this goes back to my plumb line is, you know, homesteading theory, ownership, labor theory of value versus subjective theory of value. I just think there are just tons of problems in left-wing thought in general, in a technical sense, not in a value sense. So we get away from the sort of value surmising, and they don't get worked out. You know, I was just talking earlier today. It's like the trouble with Kevin Carson is, even for Kevin Carson to claim that workers are exploited, he has to make a claim that there are such things as values out there, that there are profits and losses. And if Kevin Carson and people like Brenton Langle want to abolish money, how could they even say workers are exploited without money, without using money and prices to make their point, which is an extremely technical, autistic thought experiment. But to me, it's entirely true. It's entirely true, which goes back to the point where there's plenty of in Marx himself that is actually likable. And I think shouldn't be dismissed. I think libertarians should try to take over in some ways Marx as a superior form of thought. I'd rather deal with Kevin Carson and Roderick T. Long and those types than I would deal with the sort of half-baked Jacobin types that you see popular in institutions and think tanks as well, and the tankies and all those types. So my broad summation or in some ways an autiste or a Nietzschean, but without Christianity, there is no moral theory that is thick enough or strong enough. Even Jeffrey Tucker, from my understanding, is a Christian of some variety. And Noam Chomsky, he does draw lots of inspiration from Jewish monotheism as well. So even them, they don't escape the Abrahamic religions shadow. So the far as secular people, who I in some ways would stick to technical issues with them instead of values issues. But I'll start with Rick, and then I'll continue to Swithin. What are your own views on libertarianism? How you justify it, and how does that play out? And what do you think of my own summation of the way the thing stands? Rick?
Well, I would entirely agree with Swithin when he said that In many ways, the reasons we look to a particular form of libertarianism or libertarianism being a theory of law, that really can predict, you know, what we would say a libertarian society would end up looking like, you know, because really we're sort of projecting, and again, you know, this is the point I was making before, and Swithin made it well. We can tend to think, well, everyone's probably thinking like me, so that is probably how things will work out. Tim, you asked me to talk about what do I think of your, you know, admittedly Nietzschean views of things. I'm glad you said that they are Nietzschean, because I mean that was the word that was coming to my mind. I think you were very even-handed in assessing your own views of things. You know, Christianity probably would be, you know, the most solid ground or whatever to base a libertarian society on. But nevertheless, you know, you've said, well, I look at it as being kind of superior in some ways. And so I simply would like to see, you know, the power behind, you know, more strength to the elbow of libertarianism over something like Marxism, for instance. But you know, you see here, I mean, this is where I think that actually the right libertarians have a bit of an advantage in that they are more right wing. And what I mean by right wing is that they have a better understanding of what people are actually like, particularly, you know, people who are probably not like them, you know, as libertarians, you know, thinking very carefully about legal theories and, you know, as you said, Tim, you know, being a bit autistic, perhaps, about the intricacies of society and human interactions and that sort of thing. So, you know, the right, actually, I mean, they have a much more data-driven understanding of what people are generally like. And, you know, the idea is, you know, generally speaking, that, you know, people have a kind of entropic nature. You know, we tend towards bad habits. You know, we tend towards self-destructive behaviors and that kind of thing. And it takes a lot. It takes effort. Sometimes even effort, you know, imposed on us by family members and, you know, people in our lives who really care about us. You know, it can require coercive force from people who love us sometimes, you know, to get us back on track, or, you know, whatever metaphor we might use to talk about taking a new direction in life whereby we may more likely end up being a more ideal version of ourselves. And again, you know, the right wing, we have ideals, you know, we have ideas about virtue and we consider these to be objectively true. And, you know, even if we don't articulate it that way necessarily, people on the right generally have those ideas, even if they haven't put too much thought into it. And so I see on the left, Tim, I mean, I know, okay, that there's a lot of attractive qualities of, you know, from, you know, great thinkers on the left, or, you know, even left libertarian thinkers. The problem with the left is that they ultimately let down the very people that they are, quite sincerely, I imagine, trying to help out in society, in that they're failing to provide them with that kind of moral framework, which is solid. Yeah, you know, with something like Christianity, as you've said, you just it's absolute. And so you just it just absolutely must be adhered to. And in that sense, then you have a real moral framework with which the working class, the disadvantaged, those who would be in a position where they could be exploited, they can actually use that moral framework against elites. And so I think, you know, with the exception of, you know, maybe some think tanks, like for instance, Blue Labour in the UK, Red Tories. I don't know if that's a term you'd be more familiar with. But these groups, you know, they are much more willing to accept. You know, maybe they've already accepted certain leftist economic ideas, but they're much more prepared to accept the importance to the poor and to the disadvantaged of actually having that solid cultural framework. Without it, I'm afraid, you know, I agree with Frank Van Dunn, who, you know, really should be a much more, a much weightier figure in libertarian circles, not just because he discovered or developed argumentation ethics independently at pretty much the same time as Hansom and Hopper, but also because with that theory, he also understood that culture is very important, especially where there is a huge potential in all human societies for markets for injustice to develop. And they do. You know, man has an entropic nature. You know, you ignore that to your own demise, frankly. And so a system, a cultural framework that understands that and has mechanisms in place for dealing with it, both in, you know, the higher ranks of society, if you like, the higher echelon of society, right down to some easily exploited child. That's much more advantageous for people. And so, I mean, that's all I could say, really, where I think that the right libertarians would have more of an advantage over the left.
The approach I would take to libertarianism broadly, although I suppose my original approach was more of the autiste type, I would now see it as an outworking of general moral principles and based on sort of natural law, rather than just something that can be justified. What's very obvious, especially in Hopper and Kinsella, is the taking of Hume's is ought dichotomy as entirely unbridgeable. And Kinsella is open about that. And that's why he approaches ethics in the way he does, because he's actually he's really a relativist when it comes down to it. He says, well, you know, but libertarianism is only can be justified, so it's just a sort of purely sort of rational endeavor, but doesn't really have the kind of empirical content that the more traditional sort of pre-Humean approach to sort of ethics or political philosophy may have. So that would be the approach I would take. So I suppose I'm somewhat between sort of the Hoppian position and sort of like the right lib position, as it were. Onto Rick's entropic nature point and about the right being more sort of having more data driven. I think that's true. I think they have a better understanding of taking human nature as it kind of is, as opposed to some of the more outlandish utopian Marxist positions that I believe said we might actually live forever if we have Marxism. If I remember correctly, I think there's some late 19th century utopian Marxists, which is obviously stupid. So I do think they have the advantage there. I think that's where Hopper is broadly correct, although I think he need be more comprehensive than he can be with that. As I say, on the entropic nature, as Rick was pointing out, I think, you know, with the family situation, if the family situation gets sufficiently bad, I think you don't just, I don't think the libertarian order necessarily goes. I just think any order kind of goes and just right for being taken over by other nations who are sort of more ordered, at least they're ordered in some way. I mean, this is to some extent J.D. Unwin's argument in Sex and Culture. The more sort of libertine the society becomes, the more ripe eventually ends up being taken over by the more patriarchal societies. And he kind of weaves this narrative through history. So I think, you know, familial order is the basis for any order at all, really. And I think you can see that by on psychological things, you know. Now I know there's a cause and the effect, sort of there's you know, does the broken family background cause this, or is it the fact that there's children of people who would likely be have poor breakup. So if you get them together to have the same results. But you know, from general social science, you know, if you're from broken backgrounds, etc., your life performance on basic metrics, which almost everybody would go, yeah, that's kind of reasonable, like average lifetime income, you know, not being in jail, etc., etc., but generally being pro-social individual, kind of just isn't, it is statistically much less likely to pertain. So yeah, you really want to reduce that for any real functioning social order as such. Tim, final comments.
As far as the point about J.D. Ehrenman, I would agree if certain structures start falling apart, namely the family, to a point, everything will just fall apart. In this regard, this sort of Nietzsche and whatever might makes right type argument is entirely true. I mean, you know, what will replace Christianity Europe if not Christianity? Well, there's the great French fictional novel about, you know, Islam replacing Christianity in France. I forget the title. I cannot think of the title offhand. But yeah, I would agree that, you know, and as the historian of the Roman Empire would say, Tom Holland in his interview with N.T. Wright, the classical world is alien to almost everyone. I mean, we've been thoroughly Christianized for the past 1500 years, depending on when you want to start the clock of full-scale Christianization. So I would entirely agree with that summation. And I try to be as even-handed as I could be, but there are limitations to anyone's even-handedness. And I think even Hans Hoppe, if he's, you know, he forced doubt, you, and this goes back to liberalism in general. I would say that current liberalism, i.e. progressivism, is hostile to Christianity. I think you'd both outwardly agree with that. I would agree with that as well. That's right. I think liberalism has went too far entirely. It's sort of undermining its own order system and its own foundation. And of course, if it collapses, we'll just get the kind of bad kind of anarchy, that sort of tyranny or anarcho-tyranny as well. So I do not see some sort of bright future. In some ways, if I saw a bright future, I wouldn't be, in some way, my libertarianism is quite pessimistic in the sense I don't see some bright future. Maybe I see a bright future, but I don't see it coming via current communism. Current left-wing thought. I would agree with the entropic or fallen view of man. So in general, those are my final points. If Swithin or Rick want to make some final points, it's been quite enjoyable discussing this. Rick?
Oh, no, I'm not sure I really have anything else to say. I'll just be a broken record at this point. But, yeah, it's been an interesting conversation. Thank you for having me. Perhaps we could continue another time along similar lines, but no, very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us again, Rick. If any of you are interested, his book is The Uniqueness of Western Law, published by Arctos Media. It can be found, I'm going to say, in all good bookstores, but that's probably tautologically true.
It can be found online at Waterstones, but really Amazon is the best place to find it.
So you can get that is certainly worth a read. I would recommend reading that. And if I'd just like to say thank you everyone for listening. If you've enjoyed this show, please like, share, and subscribe on Podbean, YouTube, and on Spotify. That's where we are. Any likes and subscribes get us higher in the ratings and more people can listen to the show. And if you've got any comments about any ideas of the show or anything we should do differently or topics you'd like us to cover, please contact us at mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com. That's mindcrimelibertyshow@gmail.com.